It's sometimes hard to know what gives access to poetry, and I have a frame to put around the reading of my poems that I'll start with, and I hope it's helpful. But I'll just tell you a little bit about what I might be doing in these poems. I think it's dangerous to ask a poet what he or she thinks they're doing. But one of the resources I relied upon to write this up was actually the introduction that was done by someone else. So I read this introduction to my own poems and said, oh, that's what I was doing. Okay, all right. And then I also try to sort of think categorically a little bit to introduce what are we doing when we write a poem? What's going on there? So in these poems, I'm pursuing the question of what can we take with us from experience, from relationship, from places that we visit, and conscious of the ways in which we're always moving back and forth between the poles of loss and recovery. I'm wondering what we might recover in the act of writing or reading poetry. The poems sound a lament, but at the same time enact a retrieval almost simultaneously. These poems are very conscious that memory is prone to fragment, that poems are partly trying to gather fragments and bits into something like a nest, something that you could build or sit in or use. Looking back is a recurring figure of the poems, but they're also testing whether or not we can create containers that hold and map our experience. The book opens with a poem that refers to a method of memorizing information by placing each item to be remembered at a point along an imaginary journey. The information can then be recalled in a specific order by retracing the same route through the imaginary journey, which is a physical place. Loci is the plural for the Latin word locus, meaning place or location, and the method is called also the journey method, the imaginary, and the imaginary journeys are often referred to as memory palaces, memory journeys, or memory spaces, which is something that Jenny's been studying and that we've talked about, and actually that she introduced to me. And that is why the first poem in the book is dedicated to her, because it's a poem about Simonides. There's a Roman legend that attributes this method to that Greek poet. And
occasionally you're competing with
traffic. Oh, should I speak louder? Okay. So he reputedly discovered the technique when he was identifying bodies in the wreckage of a collapsed building that he had been sitting in just moments before. So it's a method that's very human. Someone was in a building, they left early, it collapsed, and they had to remember who was there and who died. So it's sort of this, in that sense, this kind of lament and retrieval motion is present even in this method of remembering. And people use this to create their memory palaces, right? They put things that they want to remember in a geographic location so that they can remember the location and thereby, with that mnemonic device, remember the content that they were trying to have access to. I'm conscious of the way in which these poems are attempting to place experience and people and even cities. You might know Elizabeth Bishop, who talks about she has this poem, One Art, where she talks about losing cities. And this is a book conscious of losing cities in memory to hold them. And yet they can't quite be contained, can they? What can and cannot be contained, this paradox of containment, is the subject of them as much as anything else. What we know and experience overflows containment. Thus, at any moment when we're trying to capture something, it's also not the end of the story. So there's this sense in which we are these pilgrims, this homo viator, is that how you say that, viator? Man on the way, man becoming. And we feel the need to make these cairns, these places to remember what happened here, at the same time that we're conscious that we're going somewhere, we're were in motion. But we try to mark these visitations. And I don't know if you've ever done a pilgrimage, a literal pilgrimage. Obviously, we're all doing a pilgrimage, but a literal pilgrimage where, you know, you're trying to find a place. You've probably never actually done this route before. You're finding yourself off the path and on the path. There's bad weather. There's good weather. There are animals that kind of approach you in a frightening way. There's forest. But the whole concept of the pilgrimage is, in a sense, to leave what is familiar, to leave what is comfortable, and to seek some illumination. And so it's this kind of practiced compression of the wider metaphor of our lives being a pilgrimage or a sojourn or a sense of coming from one place to another and hoping that in that space, something happens that would be worth making a cairn for, worth encountering something that a kind of visitation. In addition to searching or walking or journeying, we have to also listen and receive. This movement of call and response suggests that we must call out, but we also must listen, perceive, and wait. So often what we come to know in this process of perceiving and waiting and listening, the quiet part of call and response, is brought to us from others. And I think I would submit to you that in some sense, art is seeking to close that gap between ourselves and others. And this brings me to wanting to talk just a little bit about Josef Pieper, in his book, Only the Lover Sings, on contemplation. According to him, making art is one of the liberal activities that enables us to make contact with the world's ultimate and intrinsic foundations. I don't know if you've read him and you know how he speaks, but that's how he speaks. That in some sense, our whole goal in life is to make contact with the world's ultimate and intrinsic foundations. In fact, that's a direct phrase of his. To remember with satisfaction why we are alive, to remember and to be satisfied. He says that there are three liberal activities primarily that bring us into contact with this ultimate and intrinsic satisfaction. And that is philosophy, religious meditation, and art. And in this book, Only the Lover Sings, it's primarily about art and the way that art brings us into contact with this meaning. And he's contrasting it to our sort of workaday lives where, and not just workaday in the sense of career, but workaday even in our domestic lives, you know, so much of what we do is by necessity. So much has to be done. And of course, we've all heard the concept that leisure is the basis of culture because you have to stop and contemplate and reflect in order to have culture, in order to make culture. But he says this, wherever the arts are nourished through the festive contemplation of universal realities and their sustaining reasons, there in truth is something like a liberation occurs. The stepping out into the open under an endless sky, not only for the creative artist himself, but for the beholder as well, even the most humble. Such liberation, such foreshadowing of the ultimate and perfect fulfillment is necessary for man, almost more necessary than his daily bread, which is indeed indispensable and yet insufficient. And his argument there is that art is giving us that access to the kind of nourishment that we need, that we don't get from food and from necessity. He says to have access to this, we have to perform some activity that is meaningful only in and of itself, that is not instrumental, but that is its own good. And to do this, we have to be receptive, open, attentive. Another word for this would be contemplative. We have to also be able to celebrate a feast. This is the insight of his that I love the most. And I've always had this sort of perception or intuition that this is the case. But he really expands on the fact that in order to touch the ultimate reality of our lives, we have to be able to feast. He says that in spite of the world's riddles, we have to be willing to stop and celebrate, to enter into a reality that is not that of necessity. And so the feast is sort of that ultimate emblem of being able to stop in the midst. You know how we all have that feeling of needing to, you know, when I get everything done, then I will stop and feast. Then I'll celebrate. Then I'll rest. And he really argues for this essential part of our existence, which is to feast, and of which art partakes. You don't have the poem unless you have the feast, which doesn't mean that you don't also need the fast, that you don't also need the asceticism and the task of, you know, starving your eyes, in a sense, in order to see, in order to receive, in order to contemplate. We all have the sense that we ought to rejoice, but we can't rejoice unless we remember. According to Goethe and Pieper, the artist is the custodian of remembrance. Goethe says it this way: seen as someone called to be the custodian and eager herald of an avowed sacred reality. So in other words, we need poems, we need music, we need visual art in order to remind us of that reality below the surface. Of course, Mnemosyne, the goddess of memory, is the mother of the muses. There's no remembrance without the muses. The muses inherited from their mother the unique power that we call remembrance. The muses are brought into being. It is their task to sing the praises of all creation. To remember and to make someone else remember are two events. To remember and to remind, the words we use in English to distinguish between them. The muses help someone else to remember, namely the artist, who then remembers himself and helps others to remember. The rememberer and the one who helps others to remember both direct their attention away from the here and now and the eye-catching surface. And yet, on the other hand, the reality they now behold cannot be something totally new, something they have never experienced. It need be something already experienced, already encountered, something that indeed no longer is part of the mind's actual and present perception, and yet stands ready to be retrieved. There are large areas of reality that stand in danger of being forgotten. Here we somehow sense the artist's inner relationship to the priest, who above all is called to keep alive the remembrance of a face that our intuition just barely perceives behind all immediate and tangible reality, the face of God. And the artist, I love Alexander Schmemann's idea here that essentially, as soon as animals have been created to keep Adam company, God brings them to Adam to see what he will call them. In the Bible, a name is infinitely more than a means to distinguish one thing from another. It reveals the very essence of a thing, or rather its essence as God's gift. To name a thing, which I believe poetry is doing, is to manifest the meaning and value God gave to it. To know it as coming from God, and to know its place and function within the cosmos created by God. To name a thing is to bless God for it. So the only natural reaction of man, to whom God gave this blessed and sanctified world, is to bless God in return, to thank him, to see the world as God sees it. And in this act of gratitude and adoration and remembrance, to know, name, and possess the world. All rational, spiritual, and other qualities of man, distinguishing him from other creatures, have their focus and ultimate fulfillment in this capacity to bless God, to know, so to speak, the meaning of the thirst and hunger that constitutes our lives. And so the argument there being, again, it's another way of saying what Pieper is saying, which is that what the poem does for us, even for the poet who's writing it, is to remember, and to remember those things just under the surface, the chief of them being that we've been given a blessed God. I mean, we've been given a blessed world, that God has given us a blessed world. And our job, ultimately, all of our jobs, is to bless God back for that gift. So that's sort of my definition of what the poem is attempting to do. It's attempting to remember a reality that is constantly leaving us. It's constantly sort of being carried off into oblivion. And the act of the artist is to again, try to create a container or a cairn or locate it again in our awareness. I'll just tell you one more thing that Pieper says, and then I'll read you some poems. The artist keeps the recesses of his soul in silence and simplicity, receptive to the breath of creative inspiration, which flows by way of his own remembrance, unadulterated into the unfolding form of his work. It sings the praises of creation, which I think is interesting that that's what the muses are meant to do as well. Its poetic power speaks the kiss of the muses, and it touches the heart like a stanza from the Song of Songs. So that's the context for what the sort of office of the poem is attempting. And I'll start with the poem Love's Architect, which is a reference to Simonides. After the night he left the banquet hall just moments before its huge roof collapsed, Simonides tallied up the dead, not with a list, but with a sketch of where each friend had sat at table. He did not want to forget them. He did not want memory so prone to fragment and tangle to collapse under the double weight of love, love lost. The bodies of his friends were crushed beyond knowing. He sketched to give them forms he could name and keep on loving. Now we call this the journey method, a technique, a trick for building the memory palace. And today I'm using it, lost friend, to call you up, sticking a lemon in the bone house of my chicken, like you taught me, and picturing you on this stained oxblood couch after the meal we shared that cold spring day, the way you laughed and sat and held my pale dog who loved your touch. I can see your hands combing her silky fur while we talk of what we might plant in our gardens. Thyme, hearty kale. I do not think you want a palace. I think you know the garden is where I'll best see you. Simonides, love's devoted draftsman, I'm putting you there too, standing next to my friend and her herbs. Yes, I say to the despairing self, the doubter, this is artifice, which is why I keep sketching my own face into the scene, why I need to see myself listening. And I don't know if I did justice to that in the introduction, but in a sense, I think that's an ars poetica. In a way, just like all of our lives, you know, we have this idea of life, and we have to kind of keep reifying it, right? We have to keep reenacting it in order to remember that that's what we're doing. And so in a sense, there's this artifice of being a listener, of being a rememberer, that helps us to actually again, kind of take up the task again and perform it. It's not enough to know it once. It has to keep happening, which I think is the basis of liturgy as well. You know, you need so much repetition, whether it's a liturgy of daily life or of a service or something else, or of prayer, or even of the act of prayer. Repeating it is a kind of liturgy. Because you are constantly in the process of forgetting. And there's something very sad about that, but it's just a fact of our humanity. Reading Dostoevsky. Working the small patch of my earth in the pre-Paschal sun, weeding, planting lettuce, onions, sugar, snap peas, I dwell on Rogojin, crazy with heat, slipping the knife expertly between his beloved's ribs, then Zosima's stinking flesh rotting in the summer of his cell. No sweet odor to aid our belief, despite his holiness. Another April, next to his wife's dead body, Dostoevsky, like one of his characters reclining on the bed, writes, "Men must be free to take the way of darkness. Under the trunk of the pruned willow, I turn over the soil, terrified that I can choose." And you probably know that that's from the book The Idiot, Dostoevsky's book, where, this is a big spoiler, but in the book, there are two men contesting the hand of Nastasia, and the one who gets it as a result of her shame ultimately kills her. And of course, then the other character, Zosima, comes from the brothers Karamazov, and he is this very holy monk. And this tradition, in the Orthodox tradition, holiness often results after death in the preservation of one's body. It doesn't decay, incorruption, literal incorruption. And that does not happen to Zosima, and that's a huge crisis of faith for several. Reading St. John of the Cross. Drinking coffee in a sun-soaked city in Italy, I can bear to read John of the Cross on desolation. A woman holds her young son up to the globe, lit from within beside me on the counter. "Brazil," she says, tracing a line from its tornado to the boot where we are. She's so close, her sleeve brushes my book. Her touch assembles a world for the child, who thinks of the land as a bright shape and looks back at himself, as I did when I climbed uphill at evening away from the city of volcanic rock, or when I left my home to turn and see it. I love the glistening facade and the air huge with the voice of swallows and the smell of coffee and the women's voices as they wash the cups. White porcelain, drained in seconds. And we know it, even in a city of living stone at sunset. The office of love, the sentence says, is to wound. Garden. Do you all know the clematis? That's an English plant, right? It's a vine, and it's very hard to organize in the garden. So at least in America, a lot of people twine it around their lamp post, and they have to have all these little staples to hold it up. And if you're a lazy gardener, as I am, you forget to put the staples in to hold it up, and then you try to untangle it and latch it to your lamppost, and it doesn't go so well. Daylight comes, and each hour is built slowly. Each attachment is the structure of the clematis, which this morning I am trying to separate unwind the vine tendrils so the buds will ascend. I say tendril but mean hook or lock. Who knew what we would ask of each other in the grip of the thing? It gathers around the lamppost, heat, and all the openings shut down. Do not labor to comfort me. This vine which I've planted and tended is blind. I wanted blossoms that would climb, unhinge the sun. I can remember the way you looked at me, your blue eyes in the forsaken places. The next object, I said in my introduction that part of what poems I think try to do, Whitman said, you objects that utter forth my meanings. I love that quote of his. And if you read his poetry, you know that he was kind of constantly, finding an object that perfectly contained his meaning, whether that was grass. A child said to me, "What is the grass?" How could I answer him? I don't know what the grass is any more than he does. And then he starts to say, "It is the flag of my disposition. It is the hieroglyph. It is and essentially the hair on top of the graves." And he begins to talk about death. But he does this all the time in his poems. A spider building a web is an object that contains the soul's activity in the world. And I think that's one of the things that poetry does for us in particular. It compresses these large meanings that are really hard to hold into a container that we can hold. So to say, what is the work of the soul? The work of the soul is the work of a spider in a web. So this image, or this object that I'm presenting in the next poem called Tea Time with Inherited China, is a plate that has a bird on it. And the plate was one that I inherited from my grandmother, who was a bird watcher. She and her husband, my father, my grandparents and my father later were bird watchers. Around the margin of her china are flowers. At center, a bird my father calls a bittern, from the heron family. Such birders they were. They could sit for hours with binoculars, recording a certain science of sight. My father took up birds so he could sit with his parents and not talk about the past. Instead, calls, songs, feathers, beaks, shades, such happy ornament pluming their tongues. American bittern, Batarius, Leginitius, Pelicaniformes, Ariadne. And you can't blame him. How does a child, even a grown child, ask the questions that swim like fish just under the water? Even the water seems to want to tell, but babbles decorously when it comes to saying it. We want to put a sharp point into those shapes that have moved unclassified through our river. Instead, from our mouths come plaintive bird noises as we sip our black tea from the fragile cups with thorns in the blooms that trace the edge. It's very hard to talk about our families and our past and our childhood. So we talk about all sorts of other things, but what we're really talking about is those things that we can't talk about. And they become objects that hold our meanings. A section of this book is about going to Jerusalem for the first time and experiencing there a very unexpected attachment. And the passage from Isaiah, which is an epigraph that introduces this section that I'm going to read you several poems from, is Isaiah 66. Thus says the Lord, rejoice with Jerusalem and be glad because of her, all you who love her. Exult, exult with her, all you who were mourning over her. Oh, that you may suck fully of the milk of her comfort, that you may nurse with delight at her abundant breasts. For thus says the Lord, lo, I will spread prosperity over Jerusalem like a river, and the wealth of the nations like an overflowing torrent. As nurslings, you shall be carried in her arms and fondled in her lap, as a mother comforts her child, so will I comfort you. In Jerusalem, you shall find your comfort. I found my comfort in Jerusalem, and then I had to leave. And these poems are somewhat about that. And it was unexpected, and I think the closest that I've come to a midlife crisis, having to leave Jerusalem and re-enter life. And it's strange the way these things happen to you and you don't anticipate them or call, you know, ask for them. One of the beautiful places that I went while I was there is St. James Cathedral. And it was an Arminian church that was very, very old. One of the things that strikes me, and I try to sketch it out in the narrative of this book, is the difference between Rome and Jerusalem. How many of you have been to both places, Rome and Jerusalem? It was very odd to leave. I was teaching in the Gordon in Orvieto. You attended Gordon as an undergraduate. Did you do that semester too? And, you know, so you're in Rome a lot, and you're very conscious of the imperial Rome and of what beauty is in Rome, which is just gold, it's gilded. I mean, not everywhere there, but there's a lot of pomp and there's a lot of imperial fanfare. You walk down the streets and there's the wedding cake and there's, all these flourishes. And then you go to Jerusalem, which I did in quick succession, visiting friends, because I was already over here, and the tickets, of course, are much cheaper from Rome to Jerusalem than they are from America to Jerusalem. And you're just so struck, at least I was, by the difference between the Jerusalem, the sort of Jerusalem beauty, Palestinian beauty, and Roman beauty. Jerusalem is just so heavy, and it's dark, and it's stone. And the light comes in shafts, and it's not much light. There's a lot of darkness. And you remember in C.S. Lewis's Till We Have Faces, there's that line that holy places are dark places. And you really feel that in Jerusalem. And of course, in Rome, the holy places are light and golden places. There in Jerusalem, under a stone dome, at this hour, monks are sensing and chanting. Here in my own icon corner near the kitchen, I take a burning black cone of resin in my hand. It's been a week. I confess I've been wounded by beauty that wasn't mine to keep. There, the darkness stands calmly between me and my singing chaos. There, one monk who from his youth tended these fires whispers, "Uncross your legs. This is a holy place." Here the smells are fading and I'm afraid. I light a candle and stick it in the sand before the image of the birth giver, the world inside her, who said yes. I touch its small fire to my unclean lips. While I was in Jerusalem, I was visiting Jewish friends, and I went to a service on Shabbat with them. It was a rather unusual service because the Torah, it was not an established synagogue. And so they had to bring the Torah with them when they went to the synagogue. They couldn't keep it there. And so it was very unusual to have this Torah in a black rolling suitcase go down the sidewalk. On nights like this, but again, I just have to say that the poem is written from the position of the one who is exiled from that place and remembering that place and trying to contain it in memory. On nights like this, I follow us back to that evening we rolled the Torah in a black suitcase through the long streets of Katamon Hayashana. When we arrived and went inside, my sweater was beaded with autumn dew. Though nothing prepared me for the sweep of music through the bone, which she sang, which is the keening melody of every prayer, especially the one in the pre-dawn blue, when the sky is a room in the silent house. Ceaseless sound of those that keep festival, unspeakable delight of those that behold the ineffable beauty. She sang that song, and garments of ash fell away, bright finches undulated in the air along the weft, like the boy running his hands along my sweater's edge to touch the kindly dew, also prayed for. There was no leaving, only gladness and everlasting, in which the wandering mind was fixed. And again, I think this idea of retrieval and of memory and of container is very much tied to the fact that we always have to leave, and that the mind always wanders. And there's something in us that wants to close that gap, you know, that wants not to leave, not to wander, not to be apart, not to be separated from other people. And every now and then we have these experiences that it sort of encapsulate that desire, and then they're gone. And that's what it means to be here before the eschaton. Garden beggar map. I trace the veins of highways and side streets of the places I visited when I was in Jerusalem. I run my finger over the street where you all are now. I repeat, every moment is an opportunity to awaken our souls, to be united with God. On the atlas, it appears if I turn away and walk a long time toward the emptiness, I might reach the pool of Siloam, where Christ sent the blind man after rubbing mud where eyes should have been. He must have sat in the old city and begged kindness, as I have since then, from strangers. And perhaps he blessed them as a man blessed me near the wall. But when the light touched him and told him to go, he went and washed, the book says. How were your eyes opened? His astonished neighbors asked. But this morning in the sub-zero mapless dark of North America, I want to know, without eyes, how did you find the water? I can't tell if your absence is making a garden here inside my heart, where every day another stone is cut for the temple of the holy fire, where with the bodiless hosts we will sing together. If so, it is a wilderness where only a beggar can exist. And I want to read you an epigraph for this section, which is related to this poem. This was in an epigraph actually for Graham Greene's The End of the Affair by Leon Bloy. Man has places in his heart which do not yet exist, and into them enters suffering in order that they might have existence. I love that strange, almost hermeneutic of suffering, where in us there are these potential geographies that will be hollowed out, that will be opened up, that will be created, but only out of suffering. I think that's the center of the Beatitudes, but I don't think that most of us live that way or want to live that way. I don't want to live that way. Mare Nostrum, Jerusalem. And Mare Nostrum is a term, it's the Latin for our sea. The city that holds me is 40 miles from the sea. Here, the Atlantic is 200 from me. On a good day, I can reach the shore by breakfast. The lordly Romans called their body in the first century Mare Nostrum, meaning small world, our sea. Antioch, Alexandria, Carthage, an empire of lost cities, all near it. God with his teeming waters, tides, fathom, silence, salt, and our thirst, we call an ocean. In America, rooftops have plastic Santas for Advent. The presents are neatly wrapped and every dollar spent on twinkling lawn lights inside a clear snowball. O God, O Jerusalem, make our oceans small. Again, there's a conceiving of space and geography, and the way in which geography gets rearranged by love, relationship, desire, and absence. You probably know that metaphor has two parts, tenor and vehicle. The vehicle of a metaphor is its, there are all kinds of metaphors, but the vehicle of a metaphor is the carrying part of the metaphor. It tends to be the concrete part. So in My Love is a Red, Red Rose, the rose is the vehicle that carries the tenor, which is usually an abstraction. In this case, love. I mean, in the case of my example, love, not in the case of the poem. I am nursing the rose geranium back to health. She thinks if only she were in another climate. Several of her lovely leaves have withered, and I remove them as gently as I can. I give her water and sun in the hothouse of our small life together. We made it carefully. We both remember how this room she lives in was built from the ground up. At first, it was exhilarating when the wall came off, expanding the old house, like the childhood dream of a canopy bed in the wood. Then it got cold. Now she imagines living on a balcony made of Jerusalem stone. She thinks she would find God there and learn a new alphabet. My hand comes away from tending her with the oil of roses and something green and itchy. I want to say it's a cheat, that scent imitating the rose so closely while being a geranium. How can two essences thus opposed dwell in one plant? I'm grateful for the good life I have here at home. Still, I imagine I might be utterly myself there in that holy city. And we all do this, right? We all think that the person we really were meant to be would be possible in another place. And there's a sense in which that is not true. We may discover that person in another place, but the person we were meant to be in any city. Have you ever seen, probably not, it's a sort of exotica, but there are these branches, sort of dried flowers that you can buy, and you can stick it in water and it will come into bloom. And I occasioned to buy a couple of these and I gave them away. So I've actually never seen it happen. But this poem refers to one of those and refers to the giving of that as a gift. Farewell present with instructions. Though he did not speak English, the Egyptian who owned the spice stall told me with his hands to put this desolate branch in water, to have faith that though withered, it would flower forth as in a field at the proper time. In his shop at the souk on the dirty street with the unfed dogs, there were wonders. Tamarind, indigo, cinnamon sticks as long as my arm, frankincense, that kingly gift of distances and bittersweet burning. You told me stories that helped me believe this. You held your peace and brought hot cups of English tea. Oceans away, I eat the last of the dates. If I were to stick my nose in any spice jar, I could imagine a family at a table or a bedroom hung with cool silks. It looks like brush ready for the fire, this wasted grass. I'm giving it to you. Write to me. Tell me what it does when the water bursts it into blossom on your table where we sat in Jerusalem. It's an image from the Psalms that I really love, this sense of the dry rod, the barren woman or plant that is not bearing forth fruit, but that will flower forth in the proper time, which seems to be so much the substance of our own lives, spiritual lives as well as relational lives, our lived lives, that we sense that it's a dead branch and we are promised that it's a flower, that it will burst forth. And the sort of substance of our faith is the gap between the dry branch and the flowering. And we have to wait for so long between the two, which is why these amazing objects struck me as pretty remarkable, that supposedly they flower forth when you put them in water. But I have yet to know if that's the truth. Midlife. In my 45th year, I discover the fresh fig from Paul, my neighbor, who grows them for his own pleasure, who called me over to view their progress through the Pennsylvania summer. Hard green at first, shaped like spinning tops that children will play for hours in the street, still begging for one more spin when I called them in for dinner so many years ago. Now it's autumn, that backward-looking season, and the fig is so fat it fills my palm with its tender firmness. The incised veins run from stem to underside, which is splitting in the shape of a star, so that I can see its strange flesh through the pinhole of light it opens. It tastes sweet green, which is the shade it's turning from into a purple so deep it looks black from a distance, inside a different color altogether, newborn, labial, and the seeds are grainy and only yield to the teeth. Until now, I thought the fig a foreign fruit. I didn't know you could grow them here. This ripe weight feels good in my hand, which is also deeply veined and scarred from the time I raced a boy around the block and fell, leaning hard into a victory I could taste and wouldn't let go of for anything, not poise or safety. In Florence, there is a museum which is a preservation of a monastery, San Marco, St. Mark's. And there, Fra Angelico worked, and much of his work is there. And what's so interesting about it is that it's preserved in situ. So it's that all the cells are preserved of the monks. And it's always really fascinated me after I visited there to think about what it would be like to look at a single painting for most of your life. Of course, it was a painting by Fra Angelico, which most of us will never have the experience of. But just in terms of the memory palace, in terms of creating space to behold, to contemplate, to absorb, you know, what would it mean for us to single our vision in such a way that we looked at one beautiful painting our whole lives? And what would it mean for our abbot to have chosen that painting for us for some reason? You know, this is the painting you need in your cell to gaze upon. And you can go to this museum. I commend it to you. And did you go? Yeah, it's remarkable. Each, you know, of the cells has a different one. And I think there are something like 16 cells. So this is one of the paintings in one of the cells, Fra Angelico's Adoration. And in the Adoration, there's the juxtaposition between Christ on the cross and the adoration of the Magi. And again, we have this sense of time being kairotic, right? You know, the kairos time as opposed to chronos, where we mark time according to significant event, because these are two significant events that mark the beginning and the end of Christ's earthly life, and yet here in this cell, they're right next to each other. And often in our lives, they're quite close to each other as well. Angelico has juxtaposed his bloody Son of Man to the infant. The blood spills his ropey-veined inner arms where the tender flesh is pale, and the mica-flecked wall glitters like the surface of the moon. In this season and region, the olive trees are heavy with dark fruit. All one afternoon, I gather them with my hands to be crushed. You have to grasp the bitter flesh pits and drop them in a net. Beyond the near winter fields, only the hour bells carry over the gulf from high city to shadowed valley. The monk who woke and slept and filled his eyes with this bright painting all his days, did he see the end in the beginning? An arc, an arrow, a shape in nature? Did its heart tip burn the mark like a black candle in dull noon? My sight searches and searches as though to go to him. So many buried lamps. What shall I take for a witness? Angelico's blue, fruit breaking loose from a tree, the guard's heavy footfall on the stone floor, or the words he spoke in a tongue I could not understand when I broke into song to sound the cell, to hear the empty chamber answer. And the title of that was Fra Angelico's Adoration, San Marco, Florence. Pietà, this next poem is called, and of course the Pietà, there are many of them, but this one by Michelangelo is in St. Peter's. It's the one behind glass, you know, someone took a hammer to it, now they protect it. But there it is. And my friend, whom I was visiting in Jerusalem, is a translator, and she's Jewish. So she was translating a word for related to the Pietà. And she was asking me, you know, what's the right word here? So I got to thinking about what the right word was for the action of the Christ's mother as she held him, and of motherhood in general. So the title is Pietà, My Friend, the Translator Emails Me from Jerusalem. When Annie, herself a Jewish mother, asked for a verb to encircle the morning embrace, I turned without language to the stone Pietà I had seen on the day I climbed the cupola against my will, weeping my own death in the narrows of those stairs toward the eternal city. The youthful mother holds endlessly his lifeless body that even in marble spills her skirts, cannot be contained. I've searched for the word that suggests this failed hold, which is how I come to think of motherhood. Wreath, hedge, envelope, enfold, enclasp, none of these. Coldest summit, roots in the forest and dark water, passion of weeping tied to the body, instinct's pure hiding place. And right next to that, a poem called The Foot of the Absent Cross, about a mother who died in childbirth, who is a friend, the wife of a friend. No one dies in childbirth now, but Elisa did this year in Orvieto, birthing her fourth child, who survived. St. Francis said, the death of a sister opens the door of eternal life. And Elisa's brother, Alessandro, said, the sweetness and tenderness of the signs of God were being drawn up from the well at the edge of the city. This well is so deep, the Etruscans held off the Romans there long ago. They secured the top of the hill because they had pure water. But Luca, her husband, wants to travel to Jerusalem, to the foot of the cross. He wants to touch its ruined wood, get splinters in his fingers, his lips. That must be the way it feels to lose a young wife. Holy Sepulchre, some call it, and others Church of the Resurrection. I suppose it depends on the day. When I told the guide, it was hard to believe that Golgotha and the empty tomb could be held under one roof. He tipped his head back and laughed at me, saying my name, Christine, as if that was my answer. And I didn't know this before I went, but you know that the Church of the Resurrection, it's also called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, it does literally contain both sites, both the Calvary and the tomb where Christ was buried. And it's an enormous church, but it still is very hard to conceive of the two of them being so close to each other. And of course, they are close together in our experience, right? And they are also close together in Christ's experience. And the tomb is the site of all of our belief, but only in reference to the cross. I said to my guide, you know, I find it hard to believe that these things are so close together. And he laughed at me. Why do you find that hard to believe? Everything about Christianity is like that. He spoke a little bit of English, but that was the impression that I got from him. This poem is called Memory is Like That. In the night still of the room, you hear the wasp searching out its flower, vulgar lily with a tongue of cassia. The skirl chafes the ear like the memory of today's news. A man who'd been hung upside down by his broken ankles, journeying back to set a fire to the ruined place where he'd been tortured. He was going to set fire to it all. And you understand, the stinging bright memory you can't extinguish, the angry buzz that endures long after you squeezed all the life from the fragile winged machine, and the tail thorn that won't stop working to pump itself into your skin. But when he arrived at the hated place he meant to burn, he found three families living in the wreckage there. And I think our memory works this way. I think there's a sense in which we want to kind of chop off the things that don't fit, that are painful, that are hard to return to. And yet we can't chop them off and stay whole. There's something about the need to remember all the parts of our experience in order to stay whole. Just as in this case, this man had to not burn down the building in order to preserve the life that grew up there after the event that he experienced. This poem, Glossolalia, is a poem in honor of Pentecost yesterday, and it has an epigraph from Acts. And how is it that we hear each in our own language in which we were born? And you probably know that Glossolalia is speaking in tongues, which is a Pentecostal tradition. It's a public prayer language, private prayer language that is publicly demonstrated in Pentecostal services, of which I was a part growing up. When in my 10th year, I wanted to receive that sign. I walked the paths behind our house, naming them. The field was the color of wheat. At the creek, I laid on the bank against the different mosses and drank. I thought I might live in a spruce tree and spent the night there once with my father, who loved it all, who would have given anything for me to find that tongue, which is the Spirit of God descending in flame to the floor of the mouth, a steel ball in a bell ringing. I never did receive it, though I held its keen desire. After the rain-cold night, we went inside to eat the good bread my mother made with her hands, kneaded and set in the sun under warm white cloths to rise slowly. There are some traditions that do their baptisms in outdoor spaces like rivers and creeks. Have any of you, were any of you baptized in an environment like that? I witnessed one of them in this poem. This was the result of that. I saw the bee selving deep into the wild yellow jaw of the snapdragon, pollen crusted on the tall stamen of the throat, entering and entering. I saw the snake curled on a volunteer oak by the creek bank, earth golden, soft-bellied, fissured in the earth wall near the baptizer in his white shirt. Nearer. I saw a woman saying in the wet-scented shade, "I have been lonely and I do not wish for others to be alone." I saw a man saying, "I would be a wing of birds, a deathless father, a salve for noisome wounds." I saw them cross their arms over their chests as if in death, without assurance. I saw the baptizer pressing them into the cold flowing water and pulling them up again. You remember, related to baptism, that Nicodemus has that conversation and that question. And I'll just read you the passage that this next poem refers to, the last poem I'm going to read, taken from John 3. Now there was a man of the Pharisees named Nicodemus, a ruler of the Jews. This man came to Jesus by night and said to him, "Rabbi, we know that you are a teacher come from God, for no one can do these signs that you do unless God is with him." Jesus answered him, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born again, he cannot see the kingdom of God." Nicodemus said to him, "How can a man be born when he is old? Can he enter a second time into his mother's womb and be born?" Jesus answered, "Truly, truly, I say to you, unless one is born of water and the Spirit, he cannot enter the kingdom of God. That which is born of the flesh is flesh, and that which is born of the Spirit is spirit. Do not marvel that I said to you, you must be born again. The wind blows where it wishes, and you hear its sound, but you do not know where it comes from or where it goes. So it is with everyone who is born of the Spirit." Nicodemus said to him, "How can these things be?" And I really love that passage, which we have a cliche from, right? Born again is become a cliche. It's so much so that we almost don't even think about what it means or where it came from. And it's one of the strangest passages in the Bible, and Christ, true to form, does not answer Nicodemus's questions. St. Peter's cupola, this is called. And you know the cupola is that top part on a cathedral. And if you're at St. Peter's in Rome, you can actually climb up and go out on the roof outside that, you know, walk along the cupola, that circular part, and go out onto the roof and look out over what is called the Eternal City, Rome. And you can see all these, the whole city. And I am claustrophobic, and I got in the wrong line at St. Peter's, and that was the line I got in. And by the time I realized the line I was in, I thought I was just waiting to get into St. Peter's. It was too late to turn back. Seems to me that life is quite like that. We often get in the wrong line and can't turn back and have the experience of our life as the result. The narrows of the rising stairs were dark and hot, and too late to turn back, I felt my breath, the barred windows, the bodies likewise breathing, felt the needle in the blood compass flutter, felt the dark wave, another and another. I barely reached the top. Though there I could see the Tiber and the ancient city in which wisdom was named a gray-eyed goddess, and the vestal cells where the virgins slept. The wind outside brought tears to my eyes, and I had to take the staircase down. Now I finger the rope I bought for my neck. its rudely made wood charm a dove, who has shut its shy wings on me to brood and sit and soothe, whose voice born of water sometimes reaches me. Eternal city, I think, be near. I mark your river-carried brothers, and the she-wolf and her milk-full teats, the republic with its emperors, even Nero, and the Colosseum littered with bloody Christians, the medieval mud thick in the streets with animals grazing the imperial forum, the barbarians, the pillage. Nothing is alien to me, not the bankrupt world which wrought this place, not feckless Peter on the water, the rooster, or Nicodemus asking the nascent question. So that's the last poem in the book. Thank you for listening to me read them. I am open for a discussion or for questions of any kind. It would actually make me feel happy if you asked a question, any kind at all. We can also just talk about contemplation and beholding and the role of remembering, if you like. So anything is fair game. Does anyone have any comments or questions or discussions you want to raise? And if you would tell me your name when you do raise a question, that would help me.
Thank you so much, Elspeth. That's my name, sorry.
Thank you.
I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about history and kind of the role of that, or how you see the role of public history in the act of remembering. Like, I was particularly struck with the first poem you read, with the memory palace and the remembering as an act of love for those who are lost and who have been crushed. If you think there's any way that history can be an act of justice.
I love what you just said, remembering is an act of love. And in fact, my pastor said this year during the Paschal season, said to love is to remember. That was such a simple formulation to me of what we are doing in all of our lives, right? We are trying to remember what is real and what is true, and we're constantly like losing our grip on that rope to reality. And I think we're doing it in all sorts of ways, and we have to invoke all of the ways we have for accessing reality, for remembering reality. And I think history is one enormous, I don't want to say aid, but perhaps facet of that reality. Of course, that Romans had this idea of piety as that was part of our job. And piety is to remember the tradition, to remember the ancestors, to remember what was passed on. So I think really that's what history is. You know, it's piety. It's remembering what we came from. It's remembering that tradition. We are entirely, we are made fecund. I love this quote from Andrew Louth, where he actually uses that word, fecundation or something. But we are made fertile. We have fertile minds, if we have them, only because of what was recorded and given to us. And I mean, you all are here in Oxford. You don't need anyone to tell you this. You might need someone to remind you of this, but you know, you walk through the reading rooms and you see people with these manuscripts just sort of pouring over artifacts of the past. And it's not just the content in them. It's that contact with a reality that reminds you, again, in Pieper's words, of ultimate things, of intrinsic things. You know, I'm a human being. There were other human beings that came before me. They wrote things down. They matter to me. They were making a record. They were passing something on. They saw a little something that needed to be shared and that I find precious. And I think that public monuments you mentioned, I think you said public monuments, public history, and even, you know, like the preservation of place, again, very precious in the city, also precious in the city that we've both spent a lot of time in, Rome, or Florence, where, you know, you're sort of saving monasteries. I mean, there's so many buildings in Italy that just die because they can't be preserved because it's so expensive. But I believe that in the presence of these things, we kind of come into contact again with the human project. What are we doing? Why are we here? And I think that that's the thing that we can't hold on to. We keep losing it. Maybe it's a mercy that we lose it, because if we remembered it at all times, it might make us mad. But those things recall to us that reality, and I just think it's absolutely essential. I recently at Masaya, we had a forum on slavery, and of course you understand this is America's central conversation, whether it's being had visibly or not, right, is slavery and the sin of slavery that's deep in our past and very present. And I was so struck by a panel that the history department presented, where all seven of them gave from their specialty a sort of little snippet, an illumination, a kind of microscope on what that meant, what it was like in their era. And hearing it across all of those different time periods, you began to see this theme, but it was a theme that was so precise and so specific. You began to understand that greed and forced labor always led to these kinds of behaviors. And so you kind of understood it then in context. And it was so much more helpful to me than a lot of the kind of abstract, general, sweeping things that people were saying. And I really do think that history kind of anchors us to reality in a way that we desperately need.
Similar to what good poetry is supposed to do, isn't it? It's making you know, that similar to history, like you say, precision really yes. being more helpful than sweeping generalization. Like poetry does that by giving you a small thing often, or a very targeted kind of thing that then
yes.
speaks to you a bit more broadly, rather than just saying, oh, you know, memory is like this, you know, a straight
yes.
out kind of thing, but
yes.
coming at it in a slightly different way.
That's so helpful. And I think that's the hard thing about poetry when you're writing it, is do you have the proper fraction of precision to abstraction, or precision to universal, or you might even say vehicle to tenor. It's hard to get that right because you're in your own head.
Yeah.
But that's a really wonderful way to.
That's why I'm not able to write poetry completely.
Well, you can read it so well you don't need to write it.
So just something that what you said was making me think of is that in Latin, historia doesn't often mean history, but memoria often is the word that's used for history.
Mm.
And to memorare is to not to remember, but to narrate history.
Mm.
So
history and epic are writing, back to writing history, and they're back to writing epic are so interchangeable
yeah.
until like the 16th century.
Mm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
That's
really illuminating the language.
I wanted to ask about naming as blessing, because
mm-hmm.
I've been thinking about naming a lot. And the debate in the linguistic work that I've been doing is, which I'm sure many of us are familiar with, is the whether a name
mm-hmm.
is a social construct.
Yes.
Or whether it comes from some essence of a thing. But
yeah.
I've never heard the idea of naming as blessing and remembering as blessing. And I would just love to hear you say a little more about that.
That is such a fascinating debate, and some of our favorite people from this city have very strong opinions about it, like Tolkien and Hopkins, and Alexander Schmemann, who's more contemporary of Tolkien's, probably a little later. The idea that I think he's getting at is that that somehow when you say back to God in the language that you have, when you sort of create in response to his creation, God gives you this animal, you give back your sort of almost in Tolkien's language sub-creation out of his creation, right? Okay, here's an animal. Okay, here's a name for the animal. There's a kind of call and response, almost volleying back and forth. Here's the blessing of the thing, and it is good. And you are affirming the blessing of that original gift by deeming to give back your perception of its essence to the creator. So there's this sense in which to name a thing is to enter into that act of creation, to be a sub-creator in the image of God, and to do the only part we can do, which is derivative, right, of his gift of the world. To name the world is also to make. And the making of a name is a form of blessing God back for the blessing that he gave. And in a sense, I mean, I think Schmemann would say that man is a priest, humankind. We are all priests. And that there's a kind of, the world is like the Eucharist. And when we say what it is, as we understand it, to the extent that we understand it, it's a form of offering it up back to God. So in a sense, it's kind of like saying the world is charged with the grandeur of God. It's so charged that it sparks my own impulse to respond, and that response, which is, you know, naming is a way of knowing, right? It's a way of coming into deeper contact with a thing, and so that response is to God, is to the original gift, is that rejoicing in creation.
That's really amazing and illuminating. I was just thinking about how it made me actually think about the difference between flattery and a real compliment. Where when you describe something about someone that is true, you're not making that about them, and you're not making that up about them. You're just naming something that is real and that you happen to see.
Yes.
Versus flattery, which I don't know. I just, thank you. This is so helpful.
I had sort of along those lines. I had a friend who, whenever you would compliment her on something, for instance, in her house or something like that, she would say, "I know, isn't it wonderful?" And her, you know, her impulse was, "It's wonderful apart from me. It has nothing to do with me. You know, it's yes. Let's behold it together." Which is what you're saying, that beholding, the act of beholding a reality that exists apart from your noticing it, but you're bringing it back into play, in a sense, by noticing it.
But this is so interesting because I've, in the philosophy of linguistics that I've been, to my dismay, having to do a lot of deep digging, I've never seen the idea of naming as praise. This could be a whole new theory of linguistic meaning.
Of course, there's also that sense in which to name a thing is to extend one's understanding of a thing. And I think that in a sense we're always drilling into some unsolvable bark, right? I mean, something impenetrable. The full knowledge of a thing is not accessible to us, but the beginning of knowledge is a name, is that ability to, we can't even begin to invoke something until we have the name for it.
This reminds me of 2 weeks ago we had Valentin come and speak on the Tempest, and he was speaking about how Miranda and that is named at one point. And it's at that point that she's identified as Miranda.
Yeah.
I forget exactly. Yeah. I've been trying to look it up from my notes. And I think that there's...
She says, I wonder.
I wonder.
And wonder is her name.
And wonder is her name. Mm-hmm. And there's this sort of... Shakespeare is sort of playing with that idea of her sort of being named Miranda within the play as well, and being identified as mm-hmm. a wonder by Ariel, I think it is, I forget.
Yeah.
From the handout that we had, that was one of the...
Thank you.
I think what you're saying about naming is very important. That's part of the creativity that mm-hmm. God has endowed us with. Mm-hmm. I think it's important the way it's expressed in Genesis. God brought the animals to see what he would name them.
Yes.
That understanding is very important and was completely missed by medieval Platonist thinkers, because mm-hmm. they were misled by Plato's idea of the ideal forms. There's the ideal form of in heaven, and any particular on earth is merely a poor copy of the ideal form. And that misunderstanding is reflected in the one medieval account of that God brought an elephant to Adam, and Adam looked at it and felt it, looked at it, and said, "It looks like an elephant, it feels like an elephant, it smells like an elephant. I think I'll name it an elephant."
I love your calling our attention to that, to see what he would name it.
Yeah.
That's...
It's just funny, really, because it sounds like God doesn't know. Do you know what I mean? Like, I had no idea what the kind of original language is going on there, but, like...
Yeah.
It's the idea of possibility, isn't it? Like, it's quite overwhelming.
And almost of participation.
Yeah,
that's willing our participation.
Yeah. But does the name, so is the name just seeing what it is, or does the naming make it what it is?
Doesn't it have to be both? That, I mean, if you're seeing and you're calling a reality that is present, you're also responding to it, which... If it's a reality, you want to respond to it properly, and that's how you have a relationship with it, is in that kind of dual interaction with it.
And then, are you saying that the having a relationship with it, that you're changing?
I guess, or at least it changes the chemistry. Learning changes how you understand it. Like, can you say that? If you didn't know it in one way before, and now you know it in a different way now, I guess it's hard to say whether or not it changed or just your understanding. Mm. Did?
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Isn't that part of what the idea of containment and what cannot be contained, and the kind of paradox of containment, that in a sense of a name is partly a perception of a reality, and then that perception of as much reality as you have gets contained in a name. But that a name, I mean, reality always outspills the containers that we try to put it in. And so that kind of being and becoming that a name both contains, but it also fails to contain. But the reason it fails to contain is partly because of the richness, like the teeming life of reality. So it's not to say language is simply inadequate, perhaps, but to say reality is rich and teeming, and only so much of it can be captured at a given time, and yet it's still good to capture. And part of it, I mean, essence, I don't know, how do you capture essence, right?
I think that's kind of something that has also been playing in my mind, this idea that, Simondes, he had to remember all those people in the building, but then he had to remember the people, but really he only ever listed the names.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, I think, I don't know, the names are so sort of,
mm-hmm.
in one sense, they don't tell you anything. I'm Tom, but I could be Harry or Phil, you know, it doesn't matter. So the names of his friends in the building wouldn't have told anything really. And to him, anyway, they would have always been sort of, you know, by the by, who was in the building. But who the people were sort of, are, like you say, somehow captured in the names as well. So it's kind of necessary to have that facile sort of...
That's a beautiful analogy of what we're talking about.
Yeah.
That's beautiful.
We have names not only for things, but also for experiences. Radio for this morning program, I sometimes listen to at 9. And one of the things they mentioned was the fact that some languages have names for a particular experience that other languages don't.
I have seen those lists. Yes, like for instance, Japanese has a word for forest bathing. Did they mention that one?
Sorry,
for forest bathing, meaning just walking into a forest and being restored, as if you are bathing in the forest. There is a single Japanese word. Were there any that stuck out to you in particular?
No, no other word.
Of course, I think about Sehnsucht in the German, that sense of inconsolable longing that we don't exactly have a word for. And it's true, when you look at the language, kind of what Jenny was saying, it contains a history of consciousness, of experience, of ways that people thought that are now gone. I mean, of course, Tolkien is famous for saying that he made his stories out of names, out of language, because he would go back to a culture and see what there were names for. And on the basis of what there were names for, such as light and dark elves, he knew that they believed that such things existed. If you have names for it, you believe it existed. If you don't have names for it, you haven't even thought about it. And so it is really interesting to think about the dialectic that you're describing, the paradox of the containment. Containment limits, but not having that containment limits even further.